everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest this week will be Mary Jo Dudley. She is the director of the Cornell Farmworker Program. And it is a great program that is advocating for farm workers, and I will tell you more about that work and the work Mary Jo is doing in just a little bit. But first, I want to go over some things that are going on in and around the news, some things that you can get involved in, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. Some things going on around the city and the Northeast. Mother's Day is this weekend, of course, and Restoration Farm, which is a wonderful local organic farm here in Nassau County. They are having a farm tour and plant sale that day, if you're interested, from 9 to 3. Also, on May 16th, the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College is continuing their breakfast series, and this week it's going to be How New York City School Foods Works from the Inside. And school food has been really in the topic a lot. I don't know if any of you caught the show last week on Brian Lehr. I actually happened to be a guest, and we were talking about the school food program and how the Trump administration is trying to roll back some of the regulations that the Obama administration had put in place with Michelle Obama's school food program and Let's Move program. And the basic premise was complaints saying that healthy school lunches are not being bought by the kids, that the kids don't like it, and that you can't make healthy food taste good. And I was brought on to really just say that that's a fallacy, that that's not true, that you absolutely can make school lunches taste good and you can make them healthier, but you also need to have training. You can't just ask somebody who's used to defrosting chicken nuggets and frozen french fries to all of a sudden cook up beans and rice and tofu and make it taste good. So training needs to happen, and there needs to be some funding in place for that. But it absolutely can happen. And so anyway, if you want to Google that, you can go into the Brian Lehr Show and Google our show. But anyway, school lunch is in the news again with Scott Perdue heading up the EPA. And, you know, it's just – the Trump policies are really just affecting so many great policies that the Obama administration put into place, and we need to all stay vigilant to try to pay attention and do what we can. So if you can come to the New York City Food Policy Center, that is on May 16th from 8:30 to 10:15. A healthy breakfast is always provided. Andy Fisher's book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups, is out, and he is also doing a presentation at the CUNY Graduate School. This is going to be on May 18th from 4 to 5:30, and Andy Fisher will also be a guest on my radio show next month talking about his book, Big Hunger. So if you can get out and meet him, that would be great. May 20th, mark your calendars. That's another march against Monsanto. I know we've been having lots of marches, but we all have to stay on target. Of course, we can't all make all of them, but we should all try to make as many as we can to make our voices heard. And Monsanto is a major corporation behind so many of the pesticides, herbicides, genetically modified foods, et cetera. And they are just a bad news, and they are infiltrating our government with a revolving door, and we just need to march against them. So hope you can come out for that. You can go onto the website, March Against Monsanto, and find out where there's a march near you. Slow Food New York City is having a great event called Slow Toast, and that is going to be on May 21st. And this is raising awareness about food waste, and that's been in the news a lot, and we've talked about it a lot here on this show. And they are challenging chefs to come down and do a cook-off using food waste. So parts of the vegetable that normally would be discarded, old bread, you know, pretty much things that normally would end up in a landfill, they're challenging chefs to turn it into delicious food. And so that should be a fun event. $30 admission and includes a raffle ticket. It's at Jimmy's number 43, which is a great supporter of slow food events. So that's from 12 to 3 on May 21st. Also on May 28th, Restoration Farm is opening their farm stand, and this is the time, that weekend of Memorial Day, when lots of farmers markets are getting going and opening up. Some are opening before that. If you have not registered for CSA or Community Supported Agriculture membership yet, this is the time to be doing that. And you know, just trying to plan where you're going to be buying those healthy local fruits and vegetables this season. June 6th, New York City Food Policy at Hunter is also having an event, Saving Regional Farms, also part of their breakfast series. A couple events that my local slow food chapter is organizing and supporting. One is on June 16th. It's a slow food North Shore tour of the Brooklyn Grange Rooftop Farm and also Rooftop Reds, which is a vineyard up at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And so we're doing first a tour of the Brooklyn Grange and then a tour of the Rooftop Red Vineyard, followed by a gourmet pizza party up on the roof overlooking Manhattan. So it should be a great event, June 16th. You have to take off early from work because it does start at 3:30. 3:30 to 4:30 is the Brooklyn Grange tour, then 4:45 to 5:45 is the Rooftop Res, and then the dinner party. So hope you can make it. It's $40 for slow food members, $50 for non-members. Should be great. And then we're also having a summer solstice celebration at Restoration Farm on June 17th. So you can find out all that information and everything that I've been talking about on my website. I list all these events. Ellen Kamai, also a host on PRN, she is having a medicinal herb walk and medicine making workshop on Sunday, June 11th, also at Restoration Farm. Restoration Farm is one of our local farms in Nassau County. We don't have too many. Most of the Long Island farms are out east. So we really like to celebrate and work with the local farm whenever we can. Also, mark your calendar, July 14th through 16th is the Slow Food Nation huge event in Denver, Colorado. And this is a national event that's going to be bringing together leaders, eaters, farmers, chefs, educators, families for a weekend of tasting, tours, and talks. 3 full days in Denver. It's going to be just a wonderful event. There's going to be culinary workshops, seminars, dinners, tours. The event, the whole weekend is free, but there are certain tickets for some of the breakout sessions and tastings. So you can go onto the Slow Food Nation website to find out more about that, and buy tickets to any of the special events you want, or else just come on out for it. But it should be really great. So lots more is going on. Like I said, check out our website to find out more about these events. So I want to share my recipe with all of you, but before I do, I want to just talk a moment about an unbelievable film I saw on Tuesday night. It was called Disturbing the Peace, and it is a film that was produced by Stephen Afton as the director, and as a documentary film about the Middle East conflict. And it's really highlighting a nonprofit organization that has grown out of this conflict called Combatants for Peace. And I see lots of documentaries, and this has got to be one of the most moving documentaries I've seen, because the issue is so complicated, and yet suffering is suffering, pain is pain. And when people step into other people's shoes and understand the history and where these feelings have come from, and develop empathy and compassion, amazing things can happen. And this Combatants for Peace is a movement that is really taking root and really growing. And this film, if you can see Disturbing the Peace, I highly recommend it. And the title, interesting, Disturbing the Peace, is not really about disturbing the peace in Israel, because, as we know, there's not really peace in Israel right now. It's really about disturbing our own peace. We all become very, apathetic and platen in
participation of these issues. So disturbing the peace is really about our own lives. When we see a film like this, do we then just return back to our peaceful lives and ignore it? Or do we take a step and try to get involved and do what we can? And this issue can be applied to all these different issues that are going on in our own culture. I mean, I was talking with people about the environmental issues and climate change, and I am certainly an activist and a pro-environmentalist, and I care about climate change, and yet I also care about the coal miners and the, you know, that have been, you know, working in this field forever. Whole towns are built up around these coal mines, and then all of a sudden, you know, the coal mines are closed, and then what are they to do? And, you know, when we try to understand the parts of the country that have voted for Trump, you know, as Stephen Apkin said, you know, if we lived where they live, if we saw what they see, if we saw the news programs they see, if we heard what they hear, we would maybe feel that way too. And so we really need to understand where they're coming from and try to develop that compassion. And then with that understanding, try to come up with solutions. And so Disturbing the Peace is really a great film. If you can see it, please do. And spread the word. Okay, so my recipe this week is burdock with Asian vegetables and tempeh. And I really wanted to do something with burdock, not only because I'm growing it and I'm harvesting it, and it's beautiful. Burdock, for those that don't know, burdock root looks kind of like a black carrot. It's very dark. If you harvest them young, they're thinner than most carrots. But the root can actually go like 3 feet deep. It's, you know, really long root. And the root has a lot of medicinal qualities. It's a blood purifier. It's great for the liver, skin, circulation. And springtime, a lot of people are detoxing and a lot of liver issues happening. And so I just thought it would be really great to make something with burdock root. So this is a great recipe, burdock root with Asian vegetables and tempeh. And so I used about 3 to 4 pieces of burdock root. I actually measured it after I cut it so that you could kind of do the same. So it came out to 3 cups of julienne pieces of burdock root. So I cut them, you know, into fine, small julienne pieces. 2 carrots that I cut in a similar fashion. 1 teaspoon chopped garlic, 1 tablespoon chopped ginger, 1 tablespoon chopped turmeric, 2 tablespoons oil, 2 tablespoons mirin, and 2 tablespoons tamari. And that was just for the burdock root part. And this dish, actually, if you make it just that part, is called kimpari. And that's a Japanese condiment, kind of, that they cook up, and you can have it as a side dish, and it's really delicious by itself. But I made that separate, and then I added it to the other vegetables that I cooked. For the tempeh, I roasted that in the oven. I used 2 blocks of tempeh. Each tempeh is 8-ounce block. And I cut that into cubes. And then I tossed it with 1 tablespoon of olive oil and 1 tablespoon of chopped ginger. And I spread it out on a cookie sheet that I lined with parchment paper. And I cooked that at a 400-degree oven until golden brown. And usually, you know, the sides facing down gets golden brown first. So if you can, pull it out halfway through, like after 10 minutes or so, and turn each piece over and do it again, you know, roast it again for another 5 minutes just so it's golden brown on all sides. But this way you use a lot less oil than trying to stir fry it. But tempeh is an incredibly healthy meat alternative. It's fermented soybeans, but to make it really flavorful and for most people to like it, it really needs to be toasted well. So doing it in the oven is a great way of doing it. And then for the other vegetables, I used a wok. And so while the burdock root actually takes a long time to cook, so you're, you know, cooking that up in a cast iron skillet. I started with the burdock root. I sauteed that for like 10 minutes in some olive oil. Then I added some water to it so that it would steam a bit. Then I added the carrots. Then I added a little bit more oil and a little bit more water and let that steam separately on the side on low heat. And then after it starts getting soft, that's when I added the mirin and the tamari just to let it caramelize a little bit. And while that's cooking, you can be stir-frying the vegetables and roasting the tempeh. So the vegetables, I used the wok, and I covered the bottom with some olive oil. And it was one onion cut into slivers and then halved, 2 cups of broccoli florets cut into bite-sized pieces. I used half a napa cabbage. It's hard to get a small enough cabbage. If you can find a small cabbage, fine, but basically I had a large napa cabbage, and I cut it into half, and I only used half. And I cut that up into shreds. 2 cups sliced baby portobello mushrooms. You can use whatever mushrooms you want. Shiitakes would be great as well. 2 baby bok choys I used, and I chopped those up. 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic, 2 tablespoons of chopped ginger, 2 tablespoons of turmeric. And I'm also using that because that also has so many medicinal qualities. If you can throw that into, you know, smoothies and different stir fries, it's, you know, really great for you. 3 tablespoons mirin, 3 tablespoons tamari, and then 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil. So I started by sauteing the onions in the wok for about 5 minutes. Then I added the broccoli and cooked those for 3 minutes or so. Added the garlic, ginger, and the turmeric. Then I added the mushrooms and a little more oil and just stirred that up. When the broccoli and the mushrooms are soft, I added the napa cabbage and the bok choy, and those, you know, cook up really fast. If you turn the heat up a little bit more then and then add the mirin and the tamari, it will almost steam in the wok right there. And just cook that for a few minutes, allowing all those flavors to come together. Add the tempeh into the stir fry and add the Campari or the burdock mixture into the stir fry. And then mix it all up, drizzle on some of the dark sesame oil, and that's it. And I served it with some purple, Chinese purple rice or black rice and brown rice that I mixed together. And it was just a great dish. Came together really quite quickly. I know it sounds like a lot of different parts, but it's really quite simple. So hope you enjoy that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to all of you. Mary Jo Dudley, as I said before, is the director of the Cornell Farm Worker Program, and she's also a faculty member at Cornell University's Department of Development Sociology. And as director of the program, her work focuses on improving the living and working conditions of farm workers and their families. And the program conducts research that examines the contributions of these farm workers to the economic and social fabric of New York State. And the research provides guidance for the development of materials and activities, primarily on farm workshops, that address farm workers' concerns on topics related to health, safety, cultural issues, immigration issues, and such. And her research, you know, is really on improving the workplace relations between the farmers and the farm workers. And she's just doing really great work. And she's really been recognized a lot recently. In 2015, she was selected for the George D. Levy Engaged Teaching and Research Award at Cornell University. And she was also recognized by President Obama in 2012 at the White House Champion of Change Cesar Chavez Legacy Award. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Mary Jo. You with me, Mary Jo?
Yes, I am. It's great to hear you, Bhavani. Glad to have this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. Well, before we really get started, can we just have a little bit more information about the Cornell Farm Workers Program? Just tell us about that and, you know, and the program that it's a part of.
Sure. So the Cornell Farm Worker Program came about almost 50 years ago as a result of student interest in learning more about how to support farm workers. And so over the years, the program has been involved in different efforts. Our goal is to conduct research that will help us to understand the needs of farm workers and their families. As you mentioned, the mission is of the program is to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers and their families. And the broader goal is that the program envisions a state and a nation in which farm workers receive equal protection under the law, earn a living wage, live in comfortable housing, are safe and healthy, and receive due respect as workers and as individuals and participate fully in their communities. So one component of our program is research with farm workers to understand how people come here, why they come here, how they experience doing farm work, and the research also looks at their vision towards the future.
I just want to clarify for anyone that's listening, when we talk about farm worker, we're talking, that's not the farmer, that's not the owner of the land. The farm workers are the people that are actually working in the field. I just wanted to clarify that in case anyone was kind of lumping them all together, like farmers with farm workers.
So the farm workers might include those people who milk the cows or take care of calves or cut cabbage or pick grapes or tie grapes. It's the people who work on the farm.
Right, right.
And in New York State, we have a significant presence of workers who originate from Mexico and Guatemala. And some of the, one of the things that we look at is why would someone come from Mexico or Guatemala to, let's say, upstate New York to milk cows? And what motivates them to do so, what have they learned, and what are their plans for the future. And through this research, we see some very common themes, and based on those themes, we develop activities and materials to support farm workers as they are working towards participating fully in their communities.
And are most of these workers legal, or are most of them illegal immigrants?
Many of the workers in New York State entered the country without work authorization, so they do not have a visa to be here. They're undocumented immigrants, and that's a primary focus of working with that community is to help them to be able to navigate in their local communities. This has become difficult with policies that are really targeting those people who came in the country without work authorization. And so some of our efforts are really focused on what are the things a farm worker, an immigrant farm worker, should do in advance of an emergency. And when we talk about emergencies, we're talking about everything from a farm accident, an automobile accident, or an immigration detention. One of the challenges is nationwide, we know that over half of those people who labor on farms are undocumented. And one of the challenges is that we also see that among the undocumented community throughout the U.S., many have U.S.-born children. In fact, the statistics are that 4 million U.S.-born children have one or more undocumented parent.
Can you say that statistic again, please?
Over 4 million U.S.-born children have one or both of their parents are undocumented, one or more undocumented parent.
Wow.
And so that's
amazing.
That's a huge concern. So in our interviews with farm workers, in our research, this is something that was raised over and over again. And we work with a team of immigration attorneys and develop materials that help to inform farm workers about what can they do in advance, what can they do in particular to avoid separation from their U.S.-born children. And there is a legal document that farm workers can, or any person can fill out, that designates another adult with their parental responsibility should they be unable to take that on. So let's say if you were deported, you could in advance fill out legal forms that would designate another adult to take legal responsibility for your child. These forms need to be notarized, and for some of the farm workers who are here in the state, they don't have the proper documentation to get a federally issued photo ID, like a passport, to get these papers notarized. So we have also worked closely with the Mexican and the Guatemalan mobile consulates to support their visits in the upstate area so that farm workers can access the legal documents they need to take action to protect their U.S.-born children. So that's part of what we do. And we also do other workshops that respond to what farm workers say are their critical priorities. One arena which we've been working in is that when you have a low literacy and or non-English speaking population, how do they interact with non-Spanish speaking employers? So we've been working on the project that is, which we refer to as creating positive workplaces, and really try to find those spaces to improve communication in within the workplace. And this has a research component where we interview farm owners and managers and talk with them a little bit about their labor force. And we have found some interesting trends. We've been able to detect that transition, for example, in New York State dairy production to a Latino workforce. And the dairy producers are really quite candid in saying that they couldn't find local workers who were willing or able to take on those positions. And that coincided with a time where workers who were in the state for other harvests, in particular the apple harvest, approached some dairy farmers and said, "We're looking for work. Do you have any positions?" And so the workforce on dairy farms has transitioned dramatically over the past 15 years to a workforce that includes a heavy presence of workers from Mexico and from Guatemala. One of the challenges of this workforce is, unlike apples or other crops that can be harvested, in this workforce, there is no temporary guest worker program because dairy workers work year-round. So our efforts started on dairy farms, where we interviewed dairy producers, farm owners, and managers, and talk a little bit about the labor force, what's working, and what some of the challenges are. And then separately, we met with farm workers and talked with them about how they were experiencing the workplace. And we were able to find areas in which we could promote greater dialogue between management and the workers and actually develop some tools that would be helpful for both to accomplish their goals.
Uh-huh. Now, you had mentioned the laws. Now, farm workers, are they protected by the same laws as other workers in this country, or are they exempt from certain
Farm workers are exempt from the National Labor Relations Act, and so they are exempt from the protections within that that other workers have, such as overtime pay, a day of rest, the option of bargaining collectively. So some states have addressed that by creating legislation that's relevant for their state, but we don't have such legislation here in New York State.
Uh-huh. Right. So, it's not uncommon then for farmers to really take advantage of their farm workers. And also, I would think if many of them, have arrangements where they also get some of their living arrangements from the farmers, that they are really in a compromised position to bargain as well.
Yes, I think the main, what we have learned through our research is, which is an important piece to understanding this larger picture, is that most of the farm workers that we have interviewed, when they left home, they came here for a short period of time. And they came here because they did not see any viable economic opportunities where they lived. Many of them are from rural Mexico and rural Guatemala. And so they came to the U.S. to work on a farm for a period of time to support their families at home, but also to be able to save enough money to go home and create a business for themselves or to have another economic opportunity. What's interesting in our interviews is that it was that from the farm workers that we've been able to speak with, it's very common that when they left home, their plan was to come here for 3 years and then to return home. And so one of the factors that influences the number of hours farm workers work is that in order to come to the U.S., one has to borrow money. If you don't have a visa, you actually borrow money for someone to get you across the border. So when a farm worker arrives, typically they have a significant debt. And so the common pattern is to work as many hours as they can. And this is, it creates a trend where you have people who are working as many hours as they can, and they basically work, eat, sleep. And so that limits their interaction with communities, with people in the community, and they are very much not visible in many of the rural communities where they live. Or they might be visible when they go to Walmart every other week to do their grocery shopping and to send money home. So we have this interesting trend where farm workers in particular on dairy farms are working many hours, but they are not eligible for overtime pay. Here in New York State, there's been discussion several times over the past few years, and the discussions are ongoing now again, to pass a Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. And what that means is that there would be some protections that within the state would allow farm workers a day of rest. It would allow the option of collective bargaining, and it would also allow to make sure that people had access to unemployment insurance and workers' comp, and it would allow overtime pay of time and a half for any work performed over the 8 hours in a day or 40 hours a week. It's been very controversial. It has been raised at the state level in 2006, and it did not pass. It was again raised in 2008 and did not pass. It was again raised in 2010 and did not pass.
Mm-hmm.
2012, 2014, 2016.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that doesn't exist in New York State.
No, my question is, even if it was passed, if these are non-documented immigrants, what grounds would they have to complain anyway? I mean, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have grounds. They do have grounds, but I mean, you know, legally in our society, would they be able to take a farmer to court if they're not legally here? I mean, how could they get a farmer to stand by those rules anyway if they don't have any legal grounds to be here in the first place?
Well, these are kind of two different areas of the law, and I'm not an attorney, so I don't want to go into it in detail. But in the federal law, they entered the country without, or some people entered the country without inspection, so they're undocumented. But in the state law, if you have one of the questions really is, if the legal framework is there, will farmers follow the legal framework? And my experience has been that, for example, the legal framework is here at the state level, which designates a minimum wage for farm workers, and my experience is that the farmers pay that. One of the mm-hmm. questions is, I guess one of the tensions within some of these discussions is, even if you change the number of hours that would bring it up to overtime pay, some of the previous discussions, the component of overtime pay was that overtime pay would go into place for any farm worker that worked over 60 hours a week or over 10 hours a day. So this has been part of the discussions in previous versions of this legislation. And so some farmers say, okay, well, instead of having people work 65 hours a week, I'll just limit their hours to 60 hours. I think the challenge really is that all of the workers present to their employers a Social Security card, and the farmers have said that they are not skilled enough to determine what is a real Social Security card and what is not a real Social Security card. So it's really the focus of these discussions are about how do you create the most positive situation for those who are laboring on the farms. And there are many levels of concern to this. One of the levels of concern is safety. If you have a worker who is working 65, 70 hours a week, they're more prone to accidents. And so,
And
agriculture is a dangerous area of employment. So one of the things that we want to try to do and what we've been working on is really working with that in that space where farm owners and managers and workers can develop agreements that provide, that actually achieve some of the goals that we have, which is that they live in comfortable housing, they're safe and healthy. These are some of the larger goals of the program, and this is one of the ways in which we approach it.
Mary Jo, right now, let's just take a couple-minute break. When we come back, I'd actually like to also explore how the Trump administration's new policies are affecting some of the workers you're dealing with. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Mary Jo Dudley from the Cornell Farm Worker Program, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, forgiveness on a grand scale, as the family of American anti-apartheid activist Amy Beale worked together with two men who were involved in her 1993 murder in South Africa, working to improve conditions for South African youth and improve race relations there.
And then they started calling me Makulu. Oh, what's that? Grandmother. And my husband, Dom Kulu. It's like, what is this? I think they adopted us.
That's next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Keep listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Mary Jo Dudley from the Cornell Farm Worker Program. And she's the director there of this awesome program. Mary Jo, so can you share with us, you know, we've all been hearing about the deportation and the threat to our U.S. food system with the deportation of so many farm workers. How is this affecting the farm workers here in New York State and the people that you're working with?
Well, there are two immediate ways in which the people that we are working with express this. There has been a kind of a chilling effect on people, people being afraid that both they will encounter law enforcement and be deported, but also we have had many reports of anti-immigrant actions from their neighbors or from people who live in the area where they live. So New York State is a border state, and we have always had intensive immigration enforcement. But how this plays itself out is somewhat different. We have seen several recent events where a routine traffic stop will result in local law enforcement calling Border Patrol or immigration for translation. And this creates an environment in which the farm workers say they don't want to leave the house ever. And it plays itself out in many arenas. So one arena is if you have children going to school in the local community, that to attend a parent-teacher conference, a school concert, a sporting event, that creates a risk that you might be even a passenger in a car and you could be stopped by local law enforcement. And if they call immigration to translate, then you could be asked for your documents and you could be slated for deportation. And we've seen various events, incidents where a minor traffic infraction, meaning not coming to a complete stop at a stop sign, having a taillight out, or speeding, becomes an immigration detention. And so mm-hmm. I think the difference before Trump's election was that there seemed to be that law enforcement and immigration was really focused on those people who had some sort of criminal charge. Now it's a different ball game. It's very different. There's more active pursuing of immigrants. And so among the farm workers, there's a cloud of fear. And one thing I can say is that the communication networks between farm workers are very strong and active. And so we actually hear a lot of stories about unusual events that have happened in the past few months. In particular, people approaching, one of the challenges, for example, is that farmers provide housing for their workers. And this is required because to have workers live near your farm in many rural areas, housing shortages don't allow them to find their own housing. And over time, this has become the pattern. The pattern has become that the farmer provides housing near the farm or on the farm. However, over the years, so we've had this workforce working on farms for several years, over the years there might have been someone who lived in that farm worker housing who was going through deportation proceedings, which is a series of audiences with an immigration judge, and they may have at some point just decided to leave New York and go to another state or go home. But within the immigration system, they're in the records, there's a record of a person with a name living at a specific address. If that person did not complete their court proceedings, then they are out of status and they would be put on that list of people with criminal charges. So if, for example, ICE has a list of, we have this person, Jose or Maria X, and they live at this address, and they did not complete their deportation proceedings, they could go to that farm, that address, and ask for Jose or Maria. However, what we see happening in practice is they may go to that address and ask for Jose and Maria, and the minute the people who are living at that address open the door, those officials can look at anything in the house and eventually ask them for their immigration documents. So right. These people become, in some ways, collateral damage to someone else's actions, but nonetheless, they become part of that deportation proceeding.
Right.
To avoid that from happening, if someone comes to your, you keep your door locked, and if someone comes to your door looking for a specific individual, you could ask them if they have a warrant. And if they don't have a, if they have a warrant that has the name of someone who no longer resides in that house, or if they don't have a warrant, you're not obligated to open the door.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very strong change in patterns. People who may be working, as you may know, on dairy farms, that the shifts might be 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., or they might be 12 to 12. So you have workers who walk to the barn before and after their shift, and often the housing is left unlocked. But that has changed. People are aware that they have to lock their doors. But moreover, there's a sense that anybody who would approach you or your house or your vehicle would be a potential person who is trying to put you in deportation proceedings. So that creates the sense that anybody who is an unknown could potentially be dangerous to you. And similarly, when farm workers talk to us about the anti-immigrant sentiment they experience, the local population is experiencing that same sort of fear. So you have the line between immigrant workers and local community members has become hardened in some areas and in some cases,
mm-hmm.
where the workers are afraid to interact with anybody who is unknown to them. And some of the community members see an immigrant as a potential danger. And so it has various dimensions.
It must also have a backlash, though, for the local communities, because these are people that do live in the area that are making a somewhat livable wage, but then they do go out and spend the money. But if they're afraid to go out and spend the money and are staying home, that affects the economy. And it's not like the local people want those jobs, right? I mean, it's a fallacy to think that, you know, an American kid, you know, wants an after-school job at the farm. I mean, they just don't want to work that way. Unfortunately, isn't that
yeah? And
true?
So immediately after Trump's election, a couple of things happened, or a couple of things were communicated to me by farm workers. Some farm workers felt like they shouldn't send their kids to school immediately after the election. Some farm workers were afraid to go to town and ask the farm owner or their spouse to take them to town. Now, on some farms, that's common practice. On some farms, the farm owner, their spouse, takes people to town every 2 weeks, and they do their grocery shopping and their business in town, and then they come back. But on farms where that wasn't the case, I've heard more, it's been shared with me that more workers are really being firm on this and asking the farm owner to take them to town, with the understanding that should the farm owner be driving and stopped by local law enforcement, that they would protect them. And
uh-huh.
not necessarily the case. One of the common patterns has been that if a vehicle is stopped by local law enforcement and the passengers appear to be immigrants, that they might ask them for their documents.
Mm-hmm.
If you and I are together in a car and I'm driving, it would be highly unlikely, if I went through a stop sign and I was getting a ticket, it would be highly unlikely that they would ask you for your documents.
Right, but is it legally required that people carry their documents around with them now?
Well, if I'm driving and I don't have my license, I'm given a period of time to appear with my license, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not an attorney, so I can't tell you what's legal or what's not legal. But I think the common practice has changed where if you are an immigrant, you may be asked for your documents.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has this taint of, is that racial profiling? And racial profiling is very difficult to prove. It's a very difficult legal defense, from my understanding, because you have to show repeated patterns.
Mm-hmm. And does your program offer legal counsel? Do you work with lawyers that provide pro bono work for some of these immigrants that are getting deportation proceedings started?
Yes. So fortunately, here at Cornell, we now have a farm worker legal clinic in the law school.
Oh, good. Uh-huh.
So that is a great move forward. And by training law students how to take these cases, the director of that program, Beth Lyon, is able to also take on some cases. And we've been working together to create a kind of a mapping of where the pro bono attorneys are. The program before we had our own legal clinic has a long-standing, close working relationship with Legal Aid Society's Upstate Immigration Project. And in fact, when we host the visits of the Mexican and Guatemalan consulate, they send attorneys to do pro bono consultations with people who attend those. Recently, we've been doing a lot of family preparedness clinics, which help parents to complete those legal forms that I mentioned earlier in the program,
uh-huh.
Assign parental responsibility for their U.S.-born children. And we've had a wonderful response by pro bono attorneys through Volunteer Lawyers Project, through several organizations throughout the state. And this is something that we do on an ongoing basis. We're part of a network where we look at, we have such and such a case, and who can be approached to help that person take on their case. Nonetheless, the number of cases that these clinics and pro bono attorneys can take is quite small. And in an immigration hearing, while you have a right to an attorney, you do not have an attorney provided to you. So we see heavy demand on a somewhat small number of attorneys, but fortunately, we've also seen a tremendous response by attorneys who have volunteered to, for example, on several of the past Sundays, we've worked with families on filling these papers out, and we've had attorneys who have been there, who've given up their day off to come and help families get the legal assistance that they need. So I'd
That's
say
wonderful.
Huge demand. We're organizing and always welcoming people who could help provide this. I think the demand is much larger than the number of attorneys that could help with it, but we work together with other collaborators to try to help farm workers to get some of the legal support that they need. Not always successfully, but we try.
Right. Now, I know you work with a lot of the farms are upstate New York. What about Long Island farms? Are you also involved with some of the farmers out east?
Well, we've been primarily focused on upstate, but we're always open to collaborating in other parts of the state. Our work depends on external funding, and so depending on what we're able to get funding for, we direct our energies in that area. We have a new collaboration with folks in the Hudson Valley on a new farmer project and a farm worker training project. We're putting together some more efforts to work in some other commodities. We have a project where we've developed some materials to support visual materials, both manuals and videos, to support farmers, farm workers learning about pruning grapes and other production-based information. So the kinds of materials that we produce would be accessible and usable for farmers regardless of where they find themselves. And I'll just take this opportunity to mention the website in case someone is looking for something specific.
Please.
It's www.farmworkers.cornell.edu, and conveniently the email is farmworkers@cornell.edu. So if people, if listeners want to contact us and learn more about what they can, you know, what might be useful for them, we try to respond as quickly as we can. And really the emphasis on our program is to share materials, to make them available. We want to support farmers' efforts to create positive workplaces for workers. We want to support efforts to improve communication between farm workers and their employers. And we've developed sort of a toolkit with the support of the New York Farm Viability Institute, which includes things like bilingual worker orientation checklist, a list of things you want to go over with your workers when they begin. And since farmers provide housing, we created a very visual chart so that you, it can be laminated and put on the refrigerator in the farm worker housing, and people can circle where there's a problem, the stove isn't working, and whoever's in charge of the housing, there's a column where they can write when it's going to be fixed. This is a major area because farm workers don't want to be the one to say the cupboard door just fell off.
Right,
because they're
afraid
they'll be charged for it, which they wouldn't be, but they're afraid. So we created a tool that takes into account the owner's frustration with things fall apart and they don't tell us, and the farm worker's uncertainty, I don't want to be blamed for something breaking.
Right.
And make it anonymous and visual, which is also
important. Well, that's great. And we are just about out of time, so I'm so glad you shared the website and all that information. For listeners, just so you know, I will post that on my website, too, at IE Green, so you can get the address of the farm workers from me as well. And Mary Jo, thank you so much for joining us. Your work is phenomenal. I'm so glad to know that your program exists and that you're standing up for the people that don't have much of a voice in this country and need to.
Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Everybody out there, thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.